This is Jeff Blankford. My guest on Takes on the World today, Tyler Cullis, is an attorney at a D.C.-based law firm specializing in economic sanctions. Tyler Cullis has had extensive experience offering legal counsel on matters before the United States Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, and his writings on U.S. sanctions have been published in New York Times, The Washington Post, and CNN, amongst others. He is also formerly the legal fellow for the National Iranian American. So with the instituting of U.S. sanctions against Iran following President Trump pulling the U.S. out of the nuclear treaty with Iran, I know he must be very busy. Welcome, Tyler Cullis, to Takes on the World.
Glad to be here.
In a recent tweet on the question of Iran sanctions, you brought up a very pertinent question. Why does the United States act as though Iran were a near-peer competitor or an aggressive rollback? And you offer a number of answers. Why don't you share them with the listeners?
Well, I think there's a couple of primary reasons why the United States does that. Prime among them is the fact that there's an enormous campaign influence in Washington, D.C., that comes from the Israelis, from the Gulf Arabs. You have just tons of Saudi and Emirati funds flowing to D.C.-based think tanks, and these think tanks survive on donor money. And when they receive that donor money, they reflect the views of their donors in a lot of instances. And you just have a revolving door between the think tank community and various administrations. And, you know, because of that, the Gulf Arabs view Iran as their major competitor, and they would like the United States to view Iran as a major competitor of itself as well, because the Saudis and the Emiratis are unable to tackle the threat of Iran in the same way as if the United States had backed them up. So to a large extent, the United States treats Iran as a peer competitor for those reasons, despite the fact Iran is at best, a regional power, overextended in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere, and unable to exert any real influence beyond its region in the Middle East.
One of the things that most Americans aren't aware about, that they don't hear very much, is the fact that these sanctions, not just beginning with Trump, but before, have not only sanctioned Iran, but any country or company that chooses to do business with Iran, including and prohibiting, in fact, U.S. oil companies that would like to do business with Iran are also unable to do it. Perhaps you could talk about that, the importance of those secondary sanctions.
There's two kinds of sanctions that the United States is imposing. The United States has imposed for more than two decades now a comprehensive trade embargo with Iran, which is referred to as primary sanctions, meaning the United States prohibits its own citizens from conducting any transactions in or with Iran. So that includes the export of goods, services, and technology to Iran, as well as the import of Iranian origin goods or services, such as Iranian oil. And that has existed, as I mentioned, for over two decades now. But really beginning in the Bush and Obama era, we started to impose what are called secondary sanctions, meaning sanctions that target the conduct of foreign persons or foreign parties vis-a-vis Iran. So to give an example, the United States imposes sanctions on the purchase of Iranian petroleum, and it does so in two distinct ways. One is it threatens to cut off from the U.S. market any foreign financial institution that facilitates a transaction related to the purchase of Iranian oil. So if you're a European bank facilitating the purchase of Iranian oil, you risk being cut off from the U.S. market. And being cut off from the U.S. market means you can't clear U.S. dollars and your business model entirely collapses. The second way it does it is that it's simply if you are the purchaser itself, you risk being cut off from the U.S. market. So if you're a Chinese state entity importing Iranian petroleum, the U.S. will sanction you, and in doing so, cut you off from the U.S. market. So if you have, bonds, et cetera, denominated in U.S. dollars, going to have a little trouble moving forward. And again, that's something of a, you know, and it's for a while that wasn't so much an issue, especially during the Obama era, in the sense that there was something of an international consensus, at least between the United States and Europe, regarding the perceived threat of the Iranian nuclear program and the need for a coherent and aligned policy on dealing with it. So really, the European sanctions mirrored the American ones. So the Europeans were prohibiting the same kind of conduct from its home companies as the United States was threatening to sanction. The Trump era is a new one in the sense that there is a policy divergence between the United States and the rest of the world, and particularly the Europeans. So what you had a few weeks ago was the Europeans actually pass a blocking statute. And the blocking statute prohibits European home companies from complying with U.S. sanctions laws relating to Iran. Meaning that if you're Total, the French energy giant, and you decide to pull out from Iran because of the perceived risk of exposure to U.S. sanctions, European persons that may be affected by that decision, so you can imagine Total suppliers or even European home governments, could bring suit against Total to recover damages from their compliance with U.S. law. And that's just, you know, that brings in a really interesting conflict of law questions where if you're, you know, in the law firm I deal with, we deal with this issue quite a bit, which is you have European companies trying to navigate a situation in which their home law tells them to do one thing and U.S. law tells them to do something else. Unfortunately, for those interested in preserving the Iran nuclear deal, it seems to be the case that European companies are more frightened by the reach of U.S. law than by their own domestic laws.
And they're also having to choose between doing business with Iran and doing business in the United States. They apparently, in large numbers, have taken the easy way out, the path of least resistance, and have chosen to cut their ties and prospective investments that they were going to make in Iran. This would actually seem to be an act of war. Sanctions are as a form of warfare that brings economic damage on the country that is being subjected to them. Has that ever come up in discussions?
It does rarely. It certainly should do, and it does rarely in the United States. It does a little bit more in the international context. And to give an example, you actually have a UN special rapporteur, special rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures, today warned that Iran sanctions, that the U.S. sanctions targeting Iran are unjust and harmful and mimic a generalized economic war against the country. And again, that's something you see in the international context where people tend to have a little bit more concern about economic rights. So, you know, for instance, if the United States is intent on destroying the Iranian economy, and, you know, it's actually, you have National Security Advisor Bolton very explicitly stating that the U.S. policy is aimed at depriving Iran of the resources it needs to survive. And we're talking about an economy of 80 million people. So if you're doing that, those 80 million people have certain economic rights under various treaties to which the United States itself is a signatory. The United States would be acting in infringement of those rights, which is what the UN Special Rapporteur is talking about here. In the context of the U.S., that rarely, if ever, comes up in the debate. Even Obama-era officials don't talk about the threats to Iranian, the threat to the Iranian people that the reimposed sanctions could cause, because after all, they were they often invented a lot of these same policies targeting Iran. And really, it's just here in the U.S. the debate is about, well, our policy objective is to preserve the nuclear deal or to get rid of the nuclear deal. Do reimposed sanctions serve that purpose, or do they not serve that purpose? And that's the dividing line. And very little attention is paid to the actual human consequences in Iran from the U.S.'s very explicit attempt to destroy Iran's economy.
You mentioned early on the role of the pro-Israel lobby in Washington that has been given ample backing by the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, but for years now, actually beginning at the time or even before the Iraq war, the Israelis have been calling on the U.S. To take out Iran, go after Iran. And we have those famous images of Netanyahu speaking with this bomb cartoon in front of the UN front of the United Nations General Assembly, talking about Iran's nuclear weapons being the time bomb. But Israel was the one that really was pushing for the United States not to sign a nuclear deal, and Netanyahu was influential enough to get Congress to vote that regulation or that law that required the U.S. president to recertify the Iran nuclear deal every 90 days, which was what eventually allowed Trump to get out of the deal. Isn't that correct?
I mean, that is correct. And, you know, my criticism is actually one for the Iranians, which is the Iranians' nearsightedness in this regard, because you have to appreciate the fact that the Israelis, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, the Kuwaitis, they know how to play the game. And the game is one of building influence in Washington. The United States is the world's major superpower. It can affect the destiny of various countries, as it is doing in the case of Iran right now. And the idea is, how do you build influence in Washington to be able to steer U.S. policy in a favorable direction? And the Iranians have made no attempts whatsoever to do so. And that's partly also because they're prohibited from doing so under U.S. law, since we have an embargo. U.S. persons would be unable to provide any services, including lobbying services, on behalf of Iran. But, you know, other states in the region are not prevented from doing so. The Israelis are not prevented from doing so. The Saudis, the Emiratis, et cetera. And they wield a very extensive lobbying and influence campaign in Washington aimed at steering U.S. policy in a direction of confrontation with Iran, because Iran represents a threat to their own interests in the region. And, you know, it's a campaign that has been enormously successful. I mean, look at where we are today. And even with a President Trump who appeared, at least in the campaign, not to show much care or concern for these issues, but has nonetheless been flattered by the King of Saudi Arabia and the Prime Minister of Israel. And that flattery has gone far in leading him to withdraw from the nuclear deal and threaten, as the UN Special Rapporteur said, a generalized economic war against Iran.
This is Jeff Blankford. You're listening to Takes on the World on KZYX. My guest today is Tyler Cullis, and we're talking about the sanctions on Iran. The first sanctions re-implemented were on August 7th. What were those sanctions specifically against?
So those sanctions were a variety of sanctions. Those were sanctions targeting, for instance, Iran's currency, transactions related to Iran's currency, its sovereign debt, its trading gold, precious metals, its automotive sector, its acquisition of U.S. dollars. I mean, there were a bevy of them. In terms of the secondary sanctions, there were also certain primary sanctions that were reimposed. So, for instance, under the nuclear deal, the United States would facilitate the sale of civil aircraft, including U.S. origin civil aircraft, to Iran. The United States revoked that licensing policy and all the licenses that went along with it, and terminated the contracts that Boeing had entered into with Iran Air. So those are the sanctions that have been back in place. The real threat is the sanctions that will take effect in November, and those are sanctions that are going to target Iran's financial sector, its energy sector, its petrochemical sector, and redesignate hundreds of Iranian entities back on what OFAC calls its SDN list, which is a sanctions list.
Well, going back for a moment to the The question of Boeing, that was a $16.6 billion contract, not Trump change. And there are many stories that Iran's passenger airlines fleet is so dilapidated and has deteriorated over the years, being unable to buy new aircraft, that they've had a number of crashes and over 1,000 people have died in those air crashes. Iran desperately needs new passenger planes. And I guess the sanctions would also apply against Airbus, no?
Yeah, I mean, correct. And this is something, you know, people don't quite understand, but the U.S. sanctions target U.S. goods wherever they go. So, for instance, Airbus builds planes, but they build planes that contain more than 10% U.S. origin parts. So there's a lot of supply of U.S. parts that go into an Airbus plane. And because of that, the U.S. regards that plane as a U.S. origin aircraft by mere virtue of the fact that it contains more than 10% U.S. origin parts. So Airbus's export from France to Iran of an aircraft would be regarded as a prohibited re-export of a U.S. origin good under the trade embargo. So Airbus is barred from selling planes to Iran and would require the prior permission of the United States to do so, at risk of being cut off from the supply market of the United States. And that's true for almost every airline in the world. The United States is, you know, a leader in the aerodynamic field, and for that reason, a lot of the air manufacturers all over the world receive supplies from the United States to build their planes. And that's really what's prevented Iran from being able to purchase any new aircraft. They did receive a few aircraft from ATR a few weeks ago. But even there, there's a sanctions risk because those aircraft were provided while the licenses were in effect and before they were revoked by Trump. But nonetheless, one ATR may have missed is the fact that Iran Air will be redesignated under sanctions authorities in November. And those sanctions authorities permit the designation of any persons that provide material support to designated parties. And it's not, and that can be viewed retroactively as well. So it is entirely possible, for instance, for the Trump administration to take a look backwards at what aircraft were provided to Iran Air prior to the revocation of the license and say, you know what, that was sanctionable conduct. We're going to go after ATR or any others that provided that material support to Iran Air, including the provision of aircraft. So, you know, this is the legal risk inherent in any dealings with Iran, even when it was permitted to deal with Iran, are so serious that it's going to be a real drag on Iran's ability to survive the Trump era intact.
I know the Obama era, as you mentioned, did provide some waivers, and now in November, when oil comes, which is Iran's lifeline, the Chinese have been given waivers in the past. And India, of course, was a big ally of the United States and purchases weapons from the United States, but India also has bought oil from Iran. But the Trump administration seems to have taken a much tougher line on providing waivers than the Obama administration did. Perhaps you comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, so we've heard varying news. I mean, various officials have said different things. Originally, the Trump administration said it would be granting no waivers whatsoever, no exemptions. So oil purchasers would have to cut their purchases to zero by November of Iranian petroleum when it became clear that that was impossible without creating a massive disruption to the energy markets and increasing the price of gas at the local pump. They decided, well, we're going to have to grant some exemptions. The issue is for some of the countries, especially China, it's not even clear that the Chinese are necessarily looking for an exemption. China has, in a unique way, insulated itself from U.S. sanctions. One of the things it did is it created a shell bank. So it's a bank that has no exposure whatsoever to the United States, and it receives funds from the Chinese central bank for the purchase of Iranian oil and is able to repatriate those funds to Iran. The U.S. sanctions the bank, but because it has no exposure, those sanctions have no effect to the bank itself. And because the bank is just a shell bank, it doesn't have to have relationships with other banks, so there's no threat of being cut off from other banks. So it's really, you know, there's this open question as to what extent the Chinese will reduce their purchases of Iranian crude, even if not granted an exemption. And you can understand why China would do so. One is that they're in a trade war with the United States. So it's actually interesting. The Chinese said, well, we're not going to purchase U.S. petroleum anymore in response to the tariff issue. And then the next day they said, well, we're going to continue our purchases of Iranian oil, which is really a thumb in the eye to the Americans in a lot of ways. But two is that, you know, Iranian crude is going to sell for a very low price now because Iran is going to have very few buyers. Just as during the Obama era, Iran is going to be selling them for a very reduced premium. And for China, if they can get oil on the cheap, that's great for them, that's great for their economy, and they're going to pursue that no matter what the Americans say. It's a little less clear what Iran's other oil importers will do, such as India, South Korea, Japan. To what extent will they receive exemptions? To what extent, if they don't receive the kind of exemptions they want, will they continue to import Iranian origin petroleum, irregardless of the potential repercussions from the Americans? It's unclear what the Europeans will do. So there's a lot of lack of clarity right now. But from what I've seen, for instance, India hasn't cut its imports of Iranian origin crude as of this moment, despite the fact there's looming sanctions coming in a few months.
Well, it's interesting because it's going to be kind of a moment of truth. Trump will go both ways. He'll be friendly with and embrace a leader of some country. The next day there'll be tariffs. So, but India is a huge market, and not just for oil, but for also products from, I'm sure, from American manufacturers trying to penetrate the Indian market. So this raises all kinds of complications, which Trump doesn't seem to care about, at least when he makes his initial statements or imposes new tariffs. He's created a kind of trade war and made America's traditional allies into enemies, which, as you mentioned, kind of bolsters them in resisting the Iran sanctions. But in the long run, do you think it's going to be realistic to expect the European governments to move against the companies that abide by the U.S. boycott, a U.S. embargo?
Well, yeah, I mean, to be frank, the European response has been anemic. You know, Europe was very happy that it was able to amend its blocking statute to add those U.S. sanctions to be reimposed post-withdrawal from the nuclear deal. But nonetheless, without European action on the blocking statute, the blocking statute is totally meaningless. And this is really a moment of truth for the Europeans because the European blocking statute was first enacted back in 1996 when the U.S. passed its first sanctions law targeting Iran, the Iran Sanctions Act, which limited European energy investment in Iran's energy sector. And the Europeans passed a blocking statute prohibiting their home companies, especially Total, from complying with the U.S. law. And what happened at the time was that the Clinton administration just backed down because the Europeans had passed the statute, the Europeans threatened to go to the WTO and retaliate in other ways. And the Clinton administration said, okay, well, we'll just waive the sanctions ad infinitum. And for the first decade of the Iran Sanctions Act, it went unenforced. It only became enforced when the Europeans' policy on Iran converged with the Americans. So European law became the same as the Americans, and there was no need. There was no policy divergence at that point. And since that point, the blocking statute has remained intact. There was a nuclear deal. The U.S. waived those sanctions itself. So this is the first moment in which there is a policy divergence between the Americans and the Europeans. The Americans are taking a very hard line saying, force our sanctions, regardless of what the Europeans do. And the Europeans now have this blocking statute, and it's a moment of truth. Will it have teeth or will it not? There was a really, what I felt, some people were impressed by the German foreign minister's comments saying we need an independent payment messaging system in Europe, an independent SWIFT. And it became a really silly comment to me because SWIFT, after all, is headquartered in Europe. And so if the Europeans wanted SWIFT to act consistent with its own policy interests and not those of the Americans. All it has to do is legislate as such. The same is true if, you know, Total wants to pull out, if decides it is going to pull out of Iran. There is a way for the Europeans to force them to go back in. They can legislate them doing so. They can use this blocking statute to impose penalties on Total for acting consistent with U.S. law. It can do any number of things. I think the real danger for Europe is almost looking like a vassal of the Americans, where European home companies care more about U.S. law than their own domestic law, and are more fearful of the scope of U.S. extraterritorial sanctions than the policy interests of their home governments. So again, I think this is a real moment of truth from the Europeans. So far, the response has been anemic, but I know ideas continue to be pondered over across the Atlantic as to how to confront the Americans in the age of Trump, in an age where the United States really can't be deterred.
I like your definition of what you have to say about the Europeans, that you call a lopsided, we have a lopsided international system in which the European Union is rudderless, divided, unable to assert itself on the Middle East. But one thing you mentioned, SWIFT, I had mentioned SWIFT on a previous program, but could you explain what that is to our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, SWIFT is a it acts as an international payment messaging system. So it is a way for correspondent financial institutions, so banks all over the world, to correspond with each other and to send payment messages between each other. And SWIFT is used just worldwide. I mean, every U.S. bank uses it. And it was just an oddity that the German foreign minister could say we need an independent SWIFT. Well, you know, the United States is threatening to kick European banks out from the U.S. market, meaning that European banks will not be able to clear U.S. dollars and their entire business models will collapse. You know, Europe has its own leverage over the Americans, and one piece of that leverage is SWIFT. And the Europeans can make the same kind of threats to the Americans, which is that if you do target our banks, I'll tell you what, we're going to cut you off from SWIFT. And, you know, it's a crazy threat, but it's the same crazy threats coming out of the Trump administration right now. You know, there's ideas. For instance, the Europeans have talked about a mechanism by which oil sales from Iran will be paid from European central banks. And some members of the Trump administration have put forward the idea that we can sanction European central banks if they take up that plan. And the idea that the United States would sanction a European central bank is just absolutely ludicrous. I mean, it would cause such an economic catastrophe worldwide that would make the previous global depression look, you know, like nothing. But nonetheless, these are some of the crazy ideas that are really, you know, deterring Europe from doing anything. And the idea is you don't really want to implement these ideas, but you do want to deter the other side. And to be able to deter the other side, you have to put forward these crazy ideas. So, you know, again, the Europeans, SWIFT operates under European jurisdiction, not U.S. jurisdiction. And if the Europeans want to send a message, they can send a message via SWIFT and via, a legislation that would commandeer SWIFT to act consistent with European policy interests and not to act consistent with reimposed U.S. sanctions.
Well, this is Jeff Blankfort. You're listening to KZUX, Takes on the World. We're talking with Tyler Cullis about Iran sanctions and the complicated path that Europe is trying to find to avoid them. We have our U.S. senators. I report on my last program how 10 of them, Republicans, had sent a threatening letter to the embassies of our allies in Europe that they better hew to U.S. Sanctions because they have been approved almost unanimously by the American Congress. We have such contempt for our allies overseas, not to mention America's enemies. It's extraordinary. How is this being received in the U.S., in the European press?
I mean, not well at all. I mean, I can tell you Europe is, you know, I've had lots of discussions with Europeans, and especially folks within the European, the EU foreign policy community. And it's just, I mean, it's just total flabbergast, the idea that there would be such a policy divergence at this time. And not just, and it's not just a policy divergence in niceties. It's a policy divergence where, as you said, you have being sent letters from Republican members of Congress seeking to dictate the terms under which Europe must operate. I mean, it's the same exact kind of letter that Senator Tom Cotton sent the Iranians when Obama was had finished his negotiations with Iran to conclude the nuclear deal. It's a sense that the Americans view the Europeans as a vassal, not a partner, and that they must do as the Americans dictate. And so far, again, the European, I characterize the European response as anemic, and it's anemic because so far there's talk and not action. But nonetheless, the talk is somewhat significant. The idea that we Europeans would like to create a financial system that is that lacks a nexus to the United States. The idea that you want to create a independent payment messaging systems so that banks can communicate it with each other without being exposed to sanctions. You know, these kinds of measures weren't discussed 12 months ago. They certainly weren't discussed during the Obama era, but they are being discussed with actual vigor right now. And I have no doubt that the Europeans are very concentrated on the idea that we need to limit the effectiveness of American sanctions, because when it comes to pass that we and the Americans diverge on a policy matter, and especially a policy matter which the Europeans view as more significant to their own security interests than to the Americans, they want to be able to forcefully resist the Americans, and especially the Americans' ability to impose sanctions and threaten European companies. So, you know, the risk for the United States in this case is that because we are tackling an issue, the Iran nuclear issue, that was solved by Obama's nuclear deal, because we're relitigating that issue, we are also threatening our ability to act coercively in other arenas. You know, it's no secret that the United States wields enormous influence by its ability to prevent access to the U.S. market, but that you know, that influence is limited if other countries are trying to find end runs around it. And that's what's happening right now as a result of Trump's action withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal.
Well, that's all very interesting. It's something that you don't see discussed in the U.S. media. And I'm really glad you've been able to come on the air, Tyler Cullis, and discuss it. Is there any role in this for the WTO, the World Trade Organization?
I mean, there is. I mean, there is the opportunity for the Europeans to present a case before the WTO in the same manner that they sought to do so more than 20 years ago. I think the issue for the Europeans, and again, this is an issue I've discussed with them, is that it's really hard to figure out what animates Trump. And it's really hard to bring a case before the WTO if the WTO will take years to litigate that case. And no matter, Trump will dismiss it as irrelevant, and Trump is already planning ideas on how he can withdraw from the WTO, et cetera. So, you know, when the Europeans are trying to figure out what can deter Trump from taking actions that harm us, it's actually very hard to figure out what would deter the man. You know, one could argue that, you know, Trump lacks that kind of rationality to which deterrence is possible. If you don't know what animates the other side, if you don't know what they want, then it's hard to deter them from taking action harmful to you. So the WTO is an avenue that the Europeans can pursue, but I don't think the Europeans view it as a fruitful endeavor due to the fact that Trump will dismiss whatever findings are made at the forum.
I'm just wondering if there's any grassroots level protests developing. I mean, there were protests against the Vietnam War all over Europe, and even against the Iraq War at time. But on the ground, I'm curious to see if there will be a response upon the European public about what the United States and Trump is doing. Obviously, he's unpopular there, but that's a real question, I guess, remains to be seen. And in November, we're going to know quite a bit more. Do you have any last word as we come to the end of the hour, Tyler, for the listeners to watch for?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we're going to see, I mean, I think we have about 6 to 12 months here where the Iranians are going to gauge what the Europeans are capable of doing. And to the extent that Iran is able to continue to sell its oil at the same levels as pre-U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, I think the Iranians are intent on sticking it out through Trump. And that would be a good thing, but it's going to take a lot of effort from China, Russia, and the Europeans to resist the reimposed American sanctions and to ensure that Iran receives some benefit from its adherence to the nuclear deal.
Well, Tyler Cullis, I want to thank you very much for being our guest on Takes on the World today. I look forward to talking with you again come November. So, again, is there any way people can find out what you're doing and follow your writings?
Yeah, I mean, you can Google me. It'll come up. I work at a D.C.-based law firm, so that'll come up. And there's a whole bunch of writings on the Iran issue that'll show up as well.
Well, good. Thanks so much for being our guest today. Take care.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Bye. Bye-bye. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks very much for listening.